Well, hello, good morning. It's 11:05. It's Abbey 104 on Sunday morning, and it's Folk Tales. And in the studio today, we have Paul Peters. Paul, good morning.
Hello, how are you?
Very good, thank you. Now, you might remember Paul was with us 3 weeks ago, and we did the first instalment, Paul, would you say, of the Paul Peters story.
My life story, yeah. Where did we get to? I think I was 16, wasn't I, when we left last time?
Yeah, we didn't get very far, actually, did we? But if I remember correctly, we talked about your early life, your life at school, and the fact that you then left school and had this dream to go and be a radio DJ.
That's right.
And you went off to the Thames Estuary.
That's it, Knock John Fort in the middle of the Thames Estuary.
And that was then Radio Essex in those days. Yeah. Before that, Radio Essex now is a BBC station, isn't it?
But in those the station that is now on the air is BBC Radio Essex, as opposed to Radio Essex, which was the first Radio Essex, completely different setup, nothing to do with the BBC at all.
And just to reflect a little bit on that, you were 16 years old, you went off into this great unknown adventure, off on a little boat bobbing out into the seas, some miles off the Thames, off the coast of Essex, and you stayed out there for a few weeks.
That's it.
Decided ultimately that it wasn't right for you at that time.
Well, I think the thing really was, I was only 16 and I'd never been away from home. The only occasion I'd been away from home was I went off to a scout camp when I was probably about 10, something like that, 10 or 11. And I only stayed there one night, and then I got the train home to Mum and I said, "Oh, well, can you come to the camp and tell them that some relatives or somebody has come to see us and that I'd have to go home?" Which is what they did. And I went all the way back on the train, back to the scout camp. And they said, "Where have you been up to?" I said, "Oh, I've been down in the woods. I've had a wonderful time. But actually, I've been home to ask Mum and Dad to come and collect me," which they did.
So anyway, you decided that you didn't want to stay with the radio station at that time. And you got back to the mainland. They dropped you off at the radio station. I think this is where we got to last time.
They dropped me off at the tube station. Indeed, yep. In London, Aldgate East. Mm. And I got the tube home.
Yes. So you ended up back at home. You were still only
16.
And then I think you went back to your previous employer, didn't
you? That's right. I went back to work in the factory, making typewriter covers and covers for Gestetner duplicators and ring binders and things like that. And I carried on there quite happily for, another couple of years, something like that. Perhaps a year and a bit. I can't remember now.
Yeah, okay. But then ultimately things... You decided to move again, didn't you?
Yes. By that time, I'd met Tony, who was my, became my best friend and partner in life. And he worked for the BBC. And he said, "Well, you know, you're interested in radio and recording and music. You shouldn't be working in the factory. You should be doing something in that field." So he used to buy a magazine, and I can't think what it was called, Hi-Fi News, it's just come back to me, Hi-Fi News, and there was an advertisement in Hi-Fi News for a young man required to work in a small recording studio in London, just off Oxford Street. And he showed me this and he said, "Look, send him a letter, see if you can get the job." So we sat down and I wrote a letter and we popped it in the post. And I got a phone call a couple of days later saying, "Would you like to come for an interview?" Which I did. And it was complete change of what I've been doing in my life, completely different, because I started to meet interesting people. Now, the guy that ran this recording studio was a chap called Nicholas Moore, and he was a very sort of extrovert, I suppose you would say. He was a lovely old man, and when I say old man, he was probably in his 50s, but he seemed old to me. And my interview was in the wine bar on the corner of Oxford Street and Hanway Place, which was the little road that we were in. And the best thing I did was to buy him a pint, because the minute I bought him a pint, he said, "You've got the job, by the way." And I had some wonderful years there. I learnt a great deal from Mr. Moore, and he and his business partner and the other people that worked there, they were interesting people. We had lots and lots of unbelievably famous people come into the business for recording, editing, and we also cut discs, demo discs, and acetate discs.
Go on, drop some names.
Drop some names. Mm. Right, well, we had people like Ned Sherrin. He was quite a regular customer. We had Gloria Swanson.
Oh, yes.
Yes, Gloria Swanson, who I didn't recognise when she came in. This poor old dear arrived in a taxi, and the Hanway Place is only literally a little cobble street, one car width, and the taxis would pull up outside, and you would see the people immediately. And this taxi pulled up, and this dear old lady gets out of the taxi, and she's got one of these veils over her face. You know, they used to wear them, ladies, and back in the dark ages, a sort of fishnet-like type thing, and black, and a black hat. She was dressed all in black coat, and she was carrying this great big black handbag. And in the other hand, she had this reel of tape, and the tape was hanging down. It was a 7-inch ball of tape, and I could see her sort of walking towards the door. I rushed over, opened the door, and in she came. And she said, "Hi, you got a tape recorder that'll play this tape?" And I said, "Yes, certainly, madam. I'm sure that we can help you." And I went and got we used to hire out tape recorders as well in those days. And I went and found a tape recorder, and I put the reel of tape on and showed her how to use it and so on. And she said, "Well, I'd like to hire that for a week if I can." Do you like the accent, by the way?
It's marvellous.
And I said, "Right, well, it's 8 guineas for a week and £25 deposit, and I must have some means of identification." Well, the poor old love, she almost collapsed. She couldn't believe that I had asked her for her identification. And she looked at me and she said, "You want identification?" So I said, "Well, yes, I'm afraid so, madam." I said, "We have to have it from everybody." She tapped me on the side of the face and she said, "You poor boy." She said, "You don't recognise an old ageing movie star like me." And she fumbled in her handbag and gave me her passport. And I opened it and I read Gloria Swanson. She was absolutely lovely. I felt so embarrassed when I went home and I told my partner that this dear old lady had been in, and she reckoned she was famous. And he said, "What was her name?" And I said, "Gloria Swanson." He said, "Gloria Swanson? She is famous. She's the star of Sunset Boulevard, which is one of your favourite films." And I suddenly realised, yes, she was. So I telephoned Claridge's the next day because I wanted to apologise. And I knew she was staying at Claridge's because I've got her address on our contract. And they refused to admit that Gloria Swanson was staying with them. "No, we have nobody of that name staying here, sir. Can't help you." I said, "Well, if you see her, will you please tell her that the young man who didn't recognise her is telephoning up to apologise?" Sadly, she didn't bring the tape recorder back herself. It was sent back by somebody at Claridge's who actually brought it back. So I never saw her again. Rather sad.
Oh, lovely story there.
But then, you see, I met people like, as I said, Ned Sherrin. Roy Plumley was another guy that used to come in and we used to do things for. And I remember on one occasion him coming in towards the end of my time at Magnograph. And he came marching. He was frightfully pompous. Perhaps I'm not allowed to say that on the radio, but he was. He was frightfully pompous. And he said, "Oh, I want this tape editing and I must have it right now." So I said, "Well, I'm ever so sorry, Mr. Plumley. I'm on my own." "Well, I can't help that." So I said, "Well, if you can keep an eye on the door, I will do the tape. I can't leave the tape. I must be with you while you're doing the tape." So I said, "Right, OK, then. Well, we'll bring a machine down into the sort of part of we used to call it the shop, the sort of front entrance part. And I'll do it here." "Oh, OK, then." So I get a tape recorder and I put the tape on and I start saying, "I want that piece taken out there." So I got the Chinagraph pencil, which we used to use, marked the tape and marked it there, took it out, put it onto the splicing block, went to cut it. "No, don't cut there!" So I said, well, that's where you said you wanted it. No, 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 no. Put it back in again. So I said, look, you're making me nervous. Can you please? I'm going to cut something out of this tape in a minute and we're going to lose it. Just let me just do it my way. Well, this is vitally important. I said, look, if it's that important, take it to your friends around at the BBC because you're making me nervous and I can't work with somebody leaning over my shoulder telling me not to do this and not to do that. So finally, he did sort of stand back a bit and let me do it. And he said, this is frightfully important. This is my own Desert Island Discs. I'm at the Oxford Union tonight. And these are my eight records. I can't remember what any of them were, but that was that.
Great. Look, we're going to break for some music.
Yeah, I think that'd be a good
Your first
idea.
One is Dr. Hook.
Oh, yeah.
Why this one?
Well, we've got into the 70s now. The 1970s, that is, and there's a lot of 70s music that actually at the time I didn't really sort of appreciate, but and this is one of them, but I do appreciate Dr. Hook very much.
Dr. Hook, I can't touch the sun.
I can't touch the clouds for you. I never reach the sun for you. I never done the things that you need done for you. I stretched as high as I can reach. I guess I'm not the one for you. 'Cause I can't touch the clouds or reach the sun for you. No, I can't reach the clouds or touch the sun. I can't turn back time for you and make you sweet 16 again. I can't turn your barren fields to green again. And I won't sit around and talk of how things might have been again. No, I can't turn back time and make you young again. I can't turn back time and make you young. I hope you find somebody who can do the things I didn't do, and find the road I didn't find, and build a brighter world for you. I hope you find somebody bold enough to reach and take a hold, and guide your ever-changing mind, and free your ever-rising soul. But I can't. Inside your mind and see the things you're hoping for. And I can't help you chase the dream you're groping for. You say your arms are open wide, but Lord knows who they're open for.
Well, that's Dr. Hook and I Can't Touch the Sun from 1972 from Sloppy Seconds. That was their album in the days when they were still Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show, which lasted until about 1975, and they just simply became Dr. Hook after that, didn't they? Anyway, in the studio is Paul Peters, and this is part two of Paul's fascinating life story, which of course isn't by any means over yet. You're still doing a lot of stuff currently, aren't you?
I haven't really started yet.
No, that's right. But so we've got to the stage now where you were running this, not running this business, you were employed by this business,
yes,
hiring out equipment, but you didn't stay there too long. You moved on.
I was there
again.
For, I'm just trying to think, 67 to 71, I think it was.
Right, okay. Yeah. And what happened then? How did you come to move
away?
Well,
at the same time, I was doing mobile discos in the evenings and at weekends, and I also set up a management agency, believe it or not, with three other people, I think it was. I can't remember now. And it was called Total Management Entertainments Limited. And we used to book groups and artists into venues and restaurants and hotels and theatres, all sorts of things. And when I think back on it now, I can't believe that I was ever involved in that sort of business, because it's a funny old business. And at that time, could be a little bit dodgy, because you would put people into say a theatre or a venue, and you wouldn't get paid. you know, they would say, right, we'll pay you on the day, so we will be there, and the guy that was organising the event would be around, and then suddenly, sort of half an hour before the end of the event, he would vanish, along with all the takings, and you wouldn't get paid, and then we had to sort of sort the artists out ourselves. It was very, very difficult. But I enjoyed it, and I used to go up to the Glidodrome, the Starlight Ballroom at the Glidodrome up in Boston, in Lincolnshire, and I was a sort of DJ up there, not every Saturday, but probably one Saturday a month. And that was fun because it was a huge venue and they had thousands of people, youngsters, teenagers, from all over the Midlands, really. The number of people there, it ran into many, many thousands on a Saturday night. And I loved that, absolutely loved that, because I was showing off, and I love showing off, you see.
Is that a theme that's recurrent?
Well, yes. I never used to be a show-off, actually. At that time, I was terribly, terribly shy. And but as the years have gone by, now I'm the opposite. And I do admit that I love showing off. I used to drive poor old Jeff around the bend, but we'll get to him in a minute.
Nothing wrong with that. So this was the early 70s.
Yes.
A lot different then than it is now. And you were hiring out discos and doing this management business.
That's it, yes.
But you moved on.
Well, that all finished. The entertainments business, we closed down because one of our partners was tragically killed on Putney Bridge, and he'd been a DJ on several radio stations, including Radio Caroline, and he was tragically killed. And we lost heart in running the entertainments business. So I finally closed it down myself because the others sort of drifted away, and I closed it down with Company's House. And I had a few years that I now call my sad years, and they were sad because my first partner had drifted away, and I was... Basically, I was just the, as Jeff used to call me, the ogre that lived in the back room. And I was very sad. I had some very, very sad years. I got a job. I was desperately trying to build up my own business then, hiring out tape recorders, hiring out discos and doing recordings and things from home. And I was making a little bit of money, but nothing like the amount that I needed to live on. I mean, we were talking about a few pounds a week. And I thought, I've got to do something. And I saw an advertisement, cleaners required for a cleaning company. And I applied and I was given a job immediately. And the first day I worked in Berkeley Square House in Berkeley Square. And I was told as I was leaving, oh, tomorrow you're going to work in at High Holborn. Is that all right? They gave me the address and I went there and I worked there. I also then moved on to clean the offices of Thomas Cook, the famous travel agents, and their offices in Cowcross Street, which is right next to Smithfield Market. And I used to have to be there at, about 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. And I would walk 3 miles to the nearest tube station, get the tube into Farringdon Street, do my cleaning, and I would be finished by 9 o'clock, then get the bus home from Fleet Street all the way back to Willesden, where I lived, and then try and do my own little thing, my own little business during the day. And that went on for about, 2 or 3 years, something like that. Now, I was very poor. I didn't earn a lot of money, and I had several cats, and I used to take my cats to the PDSA in Willesden.
Just before you say I think you don't mind saying what your salary was in those days.
My salary for cleaning was £6 per week.
It wasn't a lot
for
of money, was
five
it?
Mornings a week.
Mm.
But bearing in mind we're talking, 40-odd years ago, 45 years ago. Yeah. Now it's, I don't know what the minimum rates of pay are, but it's certainly more than £6 an hour. £6 a week, and I was probably working, as I said, from about 5:30 until 9 every morning for five mornings a week. And then I'd take my bus fares and train fares out of that. So it just shows you how things have changed.
Life was tough.
It was, very tough. And as I said, because I was so poor, I used to take my cats to the PDSO in Willesden. They are an absolutely amazing organisation. And the two ladies there, the vet and her assistant, they used to feel sorry for me, and they used to give me a little magazine that they were supposed to charge a penny for, called The Penny News. And the first time they gave it to me, I said, "Oh, I haven't got a penny. I'm ever so sorry. I can't afford to buy it." And she said, "Don't be silly." She said, "You take it." She said, "We know that you love animals. You take it and read it and enjoy it." And I read in one of these Penny News magazines about the PDSA shop that they had opened in Vauxhall Bridge Road in London. And I thought, oh, they were desperate for stock. Now, back in those days, there were very few gift shops. Oxfam were the people that really had gift shops. Sue Ryder had a few gift shops, and the PDSA at that time had round about 20 in disused PDSA dispensaries and cheap premises that they could find up some back street. But they had a shop front below the office in Vauxhall Bridge Road, and they decided to turn this into a shop. Well, I went along with two African spears. And I went in, and I was very, very shy. And I said, "I've brought these for you to sell." And dear old lady in there, she said, "Oh, thank you. You know, we are so grateful for anything we can get." And as I went to walk out, she said, "Would you like to have a cup of tea?" So I said, "Oh, no, I can't stop. I've got to get to my evening cleaning job." And she said, "Oh, please do." And I said, "Well, no, I can't really." She said, "We're having strawberries and ice cream in the garden." And I said, "Well, OK then, as long as I'm not too long." And I stayed 14 years. I went the next day and helped them in the shop, well, packing envelopes, actually, for the Christmas appeal. And within a few months, I was visited by the appeals director from Dorking, head office in Dorking, as it was in those days, who asked me to go and work for the PDSA.
You
said,
so you started volunteering.
I started as a volunteer.
Yeah, and this was while you were still cleaning.
I was still doing my cleaning. Yeah.
And but that then led to employment.
Well, yes, because I decided that I had got to get a proper job. It was pointless trying to struggle on doing the cleaning and earning so little. I was getting £6 for the morning job, £6 for the evening job, which was £12 a week, plus a little bit that I was earning from my own little business. And also, I was doing programmes for BBC Radio Medway at the same time.
Okay, so how did that come about?
I sent them a tape, basically a half-an-hour programme. And I sent it to them and said, would they be interested in perhaps giving me some work? Not really expecting to hear anything. And the very next day, the telephone rang, and this guy said, "Hello, it's Jimmy Mack here." That's a Scottish accent, by the way. "Hi, it's Jimmy Mack here. I've got your tape." So I said, oh. So he said, we very, very much like it. I can't do it. I'll go back to English. We very much like it. Can we use it on the station?" So I said, "What do you mean, use it?" He said, "Well, we'd like to play it out on the station. We'll give you £4.50. I said, "What?" He said, "The quality is good enough to use on air, and we'll pay you £4.50. I said, "Really?" So he said, "Yeah, that's the going rate for a half-hour programme." And I thought, my goodness me, I have to work five mornings a week for £6. This is good, this is. Half an hour for £4.50. So I said, "Well, actually, I'd rather come and do it in the studio." I thought, well, it's not, you know, if I'm going to be on the BBC, I want to be in a BBC studio. So he said, OK then, well, if you want to come and do it in the studio, come down to Chatham. They booked a studio, and it was one evening. And I went and I met, Jimmy Mack met me at the station, drove me to the studio. 33 High Street, Chatham, Kent. It's just come back to me. And I was shown up to the studio and I was settled down. I was treated like a very important person, a VIP. And we recorded the show, which then went out about a week later, at lunchtime, about a week later. And after that, I did quite a few shows for BBC Radio Medway. And I also did the 78 show, playing 78s. Again, in those days, a lot of the programmes were only half an hour. Nowadays, of course, shows are several hours long, but back then they were just half an hour.
Shall we pause there for a moment? Because we've got lots more music here, and we want to get it in, don't we? Stylistics, stop, look, listen to your heart. Another favourite?
It is, and, well, I think you've got to do that in life. You've got to stop and you've got to go with what you think is the right thing. And I've done that all the time, all through my life.
Here we are.
You're alone all the time. Does it ever puzzle you? Have you as wide?
The Stylistics with Stop, Look, Listen to Your Heart. And that was from 1971, got to number 39 in the USA. But the version by Marvin Gaye and Diana Ross did rather better, I think, after that.
Yeah, I think it did, actually, but, yes.
Yeah. And it was actually in Bridget Jones' Diary as well, in 2001.
Was it? So, I haven't seen that yet.
We like to come up with these useless bits of information. Anyway, in the studio is Paul Peters, our own Paul Peters, who is a DJ on this station, but has done many, many fascinating things in life, and we're talking a little bit about some of those. Paul, we've got to the stage where you started work for the PDSA.
That's it.
Initially as a volunteer, but then you got taken on. In what capacity?
Well, I had a visit from... Well, I decided that I had to get a proper job. I couldn't keep struggling on as I was. And let's face it, I was doing a full day's work for the PDSA as a volunteer, which I loved. I'm not moaning in any way about that. I really enjoyed it. And I told the little old lady who originally asked me if I wanted to stay for tea, her name was Bunty, that I was going to have to look around for a proper job. I couldn't struggle on as I was. And the very next day she came in and she said, will you be able to keep an eye on the shop for me today? She used to have her desk at the back of the shop where she looked after collecting boxes and things. That was her job. And she said, I have to go to head office for a few hours. I said, yeah, of course I can, that's right. So she said, if you need any extra help, just call upstairs and Mrs. Gray will come down. Anyway, she went off to Dorking. The very next day, we had a visit from the appeals director, who I had never met before, and he chatted to me and asked me about myself and what I was doing and so on. And then he invited me out to lunch. He said, would you like to have fish and chips with me? We'll go round to the fish and chip restaurant round the corner. So I thought, oh, that sounds rather nice. I don't get that very often. And certainly not in a restaurant. So we went round and we had fish and chips. And as the fish and chips was coming to an end, as we were thinking of leaving, he said, how would you feel about coming and working for the PDSA? So I said, oh, I don't think I could do it. He said, I understand you're earning £12 a week at the moment. He said, we could offer you 15. I said, well, that's all very nice, but I honestly don't think I've got the skills to work for the PDSA. I said, what would I do? He said, just be yourself. be yourself, he said, and I want you to go out and meet people. I would want you to give talks to groups, to women's institutes, to schools, and just be yourself and do general fundraising. So I said, no, I don't think so. I honestly don't think so. He said, now, I'm not going to take no for an answer. Why don't you do it for a month? He said, and at the end of the month, if you're not happy or we're not happy with you, we part company. I said, oh, I'll think about it. But by the time we got back to the office, he had persuaded me to join the PDSA as a member of the staff for 1 month. And, yeah, I stayed 14 years. And I loved every moment of it. I truly, truly loved my work. I didn't earn a lot of money, but that money doesn't mean everything in life. As I used to tell my old mum, who thought I was money mad, money doesn't mean an awful lot to me. But I enjoyed so much what I was doing. I thought the work that we did was fantastic. I had my grumbles and groans and threatened to walk out on numerous occasions over soppy little things. But when I was a bit frustrated and a bit fed up, I would go make a point of going to one of our dispensaries, as they were called in those days, animal treatment centres, whatever you like to call them, pet hospitals these days. And I would just sit in the waiting room. I would just sit quietly in the waiting room looking at a magazine or something. And I would watch the people coming in with their pets, little old lady with her leg perhaps bandaged up because she's got ulcers on her leg, with a little pet cat in her. A basket that was probably in not much better condition than the poor old love. And I used to think, you know, we do fantastic work. What am I moaning about? The fact that I'm working in a dingy cellar without any windows. What am I grumbling about? And I would go back to the office and carry on. And I loved it. I absolutely loved my work.
What sort of things were you doing?
I did, as I said, talks. I organised the London Joint Animal Flag Day. I did the Ideal Home Exhibition for a month. I was at Crufts Dog Show for 2 days in those days, and then it went on to three. I did the Cat Show at Olympia and Earl's Court, all these places, as I said. The Royal Windsor Horse Show. I organised bazaars and even things like jumble sales in those days. I had a group of committees all over the southeast of England that I would visit for meetings, and I would go to their coffee mornings. And it was just generally, back in those days, it was called social secretary. I was the PDSA social secretary. As the years went by, it changed to regional appeals organiser. And then just before I left, I was regional appeals director.
You became the face of the PDSA.
I was locally. Mr. PDSA in London. I was London, the South East. I was Mr. PDSA. Yeah. And I still have helpers from those days that are in contact with me after all these years. I had my army of old ladies. I mean, most of them sadly have left us now. But I had my army of old ladies who would never let Mr. P down. Never, never. They would trudge through the snow. It could be 6 feet deep, rather than let me down. And it was absolutely fantastic. I loved it. And I always say to people, if they're unhappy in their work, go and see if you can get a job with a charity. OK, you may not be earning the $50,000 a year or whatever you're earning at the moment. You may come down to $15,000. But you'll be happy and you'll be doing something so worthwhile. And if you can afford not to have a salary, go work at a charity shop. Go and work for a charity. Doing whatever, because you will get so much pleasure out of it, meeting people, and so much pleasure.
And you met some really interesting people. You were just talking before we came on air about Patricia Hayes.
Yes, Pat Hayes was, I don't know whether you remember Patricia Hayes, she was a lovely old actress. She classed herself as a jobbing actor. And she used to be in things like Hugh and I and, Steptoe and Son and all these sort of little dramas that were on the television, comedy dramas back in the 60s and 70s. And then she appeared with another Pat Coombs in Edna the Inebriate Woman. And that made her. It was absolutely fantastic television. And they were two old tramps, and they were absolutely fantastic. Well, Patricia Hayes was a very, very keen animal lover, and she had two little sausage dogs. I don't know their technical name, but to me, they were little sausage dogs. And she used to do a huge amount for the PDSA, and it was always me that she did it for, not me personally, but because it was my area. And we became great friends. And I remember we did a dog walk in Hyde Park, and actually nobody turned up to this dog walk. Only Patricia Hayes, Jeff and me, we were the only ones and on a Sunday morning in Hyde Park. But we got fantastic press coverage, because doing things on a Sunday is a good day, because there's not much going on normally, and the press are only too keen to have something to put in the papers the next morning. So a dog walk in Hyde Park with Patricia Hayes right at the front with all these thousands of people. They weren't there at all. was good news. And we marched backwards and forwards, up and down, for the photographers to take photographs. Another occasion, she came and opened a dog show, and Jeff and I went to collect her. You'll hear about Jeff in a minute. Jeff and I went to collect her from her home, and she was late, and she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, I'm holding you boys up. Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear." And I said, "Don't worry, Pat. They'll wait for you. You're the star of the show." "I know, but I shouldn't be late." Anyway, we finally got her into my little Renault 4 car with the two little sausage dogs, and she was sat in the back. And we're driving up. We were going to Kenton Harrow for a dog show, which she was going to open. And we got to Harlesden, and just as we were driving through Harlesden by the park, there was a mounted police officer pulls right in front of the car and puts his hand up to stop. And she says, "What's going on?" I said, "Oh, I think the carnival's coming through, Pat." "Carnival? Oh, I'm going to be late. I'm going to be late." I said, "Just calm down. We're going to be all right. Don't worry. They'll wait for us." Anyway, she said, "Wind the window down. Wind the window down." So I opened the window of the car, and she calls out to the policeman who's on his horse, and she's going, "Cooey, cooey, cooey." And he looks down, and he recognises her, and he says, "Oh," he clip-clop, clip-clop, he comes across. He says, "Oh, hello, Miss Hayes, what can I do for you?" "Oh, I'm going to be late," she said, "and I'm opening this very special dog show." So he said, "Oh," she said, can you stop those people just for a minute so that we can get through?" "Not a problem, not a problem, Miss Hayes." He drives, rides up on his horse and puts his hand up and stops the whole of the procession. We drive through, and he waves us goodbye, and she calls out the window, "Thank you, thank you." And off we go, and we go, and she opens the dog show. Absolutely fantastic.
Lots of wonderful stories like that.
Yeah.
We're going to take your next track, because in the middle of all this, you met a young man called Jeff Kemp, didn't you?
Yep. I went to a party.
We're going to talk a little bit more about Jeff in a minute.
Yeah.
Your next track is Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan. Ah, yeah. Now this takes me back to my days at Magnograph, the recording company. Because I don't know whether I mentioned earlier, but I used to cut these acetate records. And I used to cut this one over and over again for his music publishers.
Lay, Lady, Lay.
That's it.
Lay, Lady, Lay. Lay across my big breast bed. Lay, Lady, Lay. Lay across my big breast bed. Whatever colors you have in your mind, I show them to you and you see them shine. Lay, Lady, Lay. Lay across my big breast bed. Stay, Lady, stay. Stay with your man a while. Until the break of day, let me see you make 'em smile. His clothes are dirty, but his hands are clean. And you're the best thing that he's ever seen. Stay, Lady, stay. Stay with your man a while. Why wait any longer for the world to begin? You can have your cake and eat it too. Why longer for the one you love when he's standing in front of you. Lay, 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 lay across my big breast bed.
Ah, wonderful track. Yeah. Bob Dylan with Lay, Lady, yeah. Lay from 1969 from Nashville Skyline. Originally written to be the soundtrack of The Midnight Cowboy.
Yes, it was. I'd forgotten that.
It didn't make it because it was too late and they chose something else.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's Folk Tales on Abbey 104, and in the studio is Paul Peters, our own Paul Peters. We call him our own now, but he's not always been ours. He's been all sorts of other people's. In the meantime, and Paul, we've got you were with the PDSA for 14 years,
yes.
And as I say, in the middle of all this, 1975, you met this chap called Jeff.
Yep,
who became quite a big part of your life.
Yeah, I went to a party and we got talking, and we spent 42 years of our lives together, which was fantastic for me, absolutely fantastic. Jeff encouraged me to do so many things that perhaps I wouldn't have done if I hadn't have met him. I can tell you I wouldn't be sitting here, and I wouldn't be at Abbey 104 if it wasn't for Jeff, because Jeff always used to back me and push me in the direction that he knew I wanted to go. But as I said, you would never believe it, but actually I was very, very shy, and I still am shy. I've had to push myself a bit more in the last few months since he left us, but he was a lovely, lovely guy, and he became my partner and my soulmate for.
And you did lots and lots of things
together. Oh, fantastic!
And you
yeah.
built businesses up, didn't
we
you?
We did from nothing. We were both very poor. I mean, well, I won't say poor. Jeff was better than me because he had a university education. He had qualifications, and he's got a big folder of qualifications. Mine was only my 25-yard swimmer certificate that I told you about in the last edition of this program.
I think to that you added a bicycle proficiency.
Oh yes, yeah, but we're not allowed to talk about
it. Oh no, okay. All right, so you met Jeff in 1975, and as I say, he became a big part of your life. But you were still with the PDSA for quite a while.
Oh yes. Well, another 10, 11 years. Oh, okay. And Jeff would. Jeff, when he met up with me, he didn't realise he was taking on the PDSA as well, because Jeff would have to help me at weekends at things like the, as I said, the Ideal Home Exhibition, cat shows, Crufts. Jeff was always there at Crufts, carrying in the boxes and setting up the stand and making sandwiches for all the helpers, which we used to take along, and thermos flasks of coffee and tea, so that we didn't have to buy stuff at the exhibition hall at their exorbitant prices, which would have meant that they would have had to have come out of expenses, which I never had expenses. I kept my expenses so low that the accounts department used to query them, because they couldn't understand how Mr. P only had on his expense sheet for a month probably £2.50 or something. And they say, well, you're not claiming for things that you're spending out on. And I say, no, everything is there. I promise you, everything is there. And, we had a long, long, happy life, interesting life together. Ups and downs, the same as everybody has ups and downs. But when I think back, Jeff was such a great support for me at the PDSA. He became part of the PDSA.
But he had his own career at the time, presumably.
Jeff, when I first met Jeff, he was working for Sainsbury's. And he was, originally he was a wines and spirits buyer. And then he transferred to bakery buying. And then he became bakery quality control. And I used to go out with him. And I remember one trip that we did, we went right the way along the south coast, and we called at all the Sainsbury's branches, and Jeff had to get samples and advise them on different things, the way they were displaying. I mean, it's different now, obviously, how they were displaying the bread and the cakes and so on. And as we went along, we played our next record, which was he was a big fan of Charles Aznavour. And
well, should we play that now?
Yeah, go on then, play it.
So Charles Aznavour, and which one?
I can't remember what I've chosen. For so many good ones.
Let's have a look on the list. Oh, it's The Old Fashioned Way.
That's actually. It. Yeah.
Great
I told
track.
You the wrong title, didn't I?
You did.
Well,
dance in the old-fashioned way. Won't you stay in my arms? Just melt against my skin and let me feel your heart. Don't let the music win by dancing far apart. Come close where you belong. Let's hear our secret song. Dance in the old-fashioned way. Won't you stay in my arms? And we'll discover how just close our eyes and dance around the floor. That gay, old-fashioned way that makes me love you more. Come closer. Forget all the others.
That's Charles Aznavour and The Old Fashioned Way from 1973. It was in the UK charts for 15 weeks.
Was it?
It did rather well, didn't it? It also covered, well, by, not covered, I suppose, but Fred Astaire actually did it, Petula Clark, Shirley Bassey, and Helen Reddy, amongst others. So there we are. Paul Peters is our guest in the studio today on Folk Tales. And Paul, we've been talking about your life with the PDSA and how you come to meet Jeff. And, well, you stayed with the PDSA for 14 years, didn't you?
Yeah.
Left in 1986. Yes. Now, you loved the job, obviously.
Oh, you've loved it.
Why did you leave, ultimately?
I always wanted to run my own business. And I was then towards my mid to late 30s. And I thought, if I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it. So I got this idea in my head that I would like to run a hotel. Jeff always wanted to run a restaurant. He was a fantastic cook. He really was a fantastic cook. And he always wanted a restaurant. So I put the idea to him, why don't we buy a hotel? Well, over the years, I had been, because I worked for a charity and I didn't earn a lot, and I was actually renting a flat from the PDSA over one of their branches in London, because even back then, it was impossible to buy a house or a flat in London unless you had a good salary. And my idea was, right, well, OK, then, I used to always speak my mind at the PDSA, and I would go to meetings, and if I didn't agree with something and I thought it wasn't what the charity should be doing, I would say. And I thought, one of these days I'm going to say, oh, stick your job, I'm out. I never did. But I thought, if I do that, I'm going to have to leave my flat, because it was like a tithe accommodation. So I bought a little cottage in North Wales for literally a few hundred pounds, which I'd got mostly in savings. My mum and dad lent me a little bit, and I bought this little cottage. So I thought, at least I've got somewhere I can go and live with my cats if I ever lose my temper and walk out. And then I bought another one. I went to visit some helpers of mine who'd retired down to South Wales. And they bought a little cottage for £1,500 down there. And I thought, ooh, I'll go down and see them, see what they got for their £1,500. Well, I got down there ever so early. It was a January day and it started snowing. And I thought, oh, dear, I hope I get home all right. And I got down there about 9 o'clock in the morning. So I went into Aberdare, and in the window of this sort of insurance broker's, there was a card and it said, house for sale, £1,000. In Abercumboy. And I thought, oh, that sounds good. Only £1,000, this one. So I went in and I got chatting to the chap who ran this place. And he said, oh, here's the key. Go and have a look at it. As you can tell, I'm not very good with accents. Go and have a look at it. I went and looked to the house. And I thought, oh, this is marvellous. It was on the main road into Cardiff. Only £1,000. Well, I hadn't got any money because I spent it all on the other one. I thought, how am I going to get £1,000? Oh, this is going to be difficult, but I want to buy it. So I went back and I said to the chap, I'd like to buy the house. And he said, oh, how much are you going to give me for it then? And I thought, well, I knew there was a catch. I said, but it says £1,000 in the window. So he said, did you say £900? So I said, yeah, £900. He said, ah, he said, now, let me teach you a little lesson, he said. If you'd have offered me £800, I would have snapped your arm off, he said. But you were offering me the full asking price, £1,000, he said. I thought that was a bit mean, he said. So I'm going to let you have it for £900, he said. But learn this lesson. Never pay the going price. Always ask, see if you can get a bit cheaper. And those houses increased in value, which eventually gave me the money to buy a house in London, another property that they couldn't sell. It was one that couldn't sell at auction, £17,500. And a year later, or just over a year later, the money that I got for that house bought the hotel in Cliftonville, okay. Margate.
We're beginning to run short on time. Just tell us how you came to leave the PDSA.
I gave 6 months' notice to the PDSA, which I hated doing. I absolutely hated doing. And I was based at Croydon then, at the Animal Treatment Centre in Croydon, which I had helped raise the money to build. It cost £375,000 in 1976, would probably cost something like, oh, £2 to £3 million to build now. And they couldn't find anybody to replace me. So the day I left, I left a note on my desk for whoever took over. I passed my keys into the chief vet, as I call her, and walked to East Croydon Station, got the train down to Margate, and that was that.
And what was your intention when you left? What were you going to do?
Well, running the hotel.
Oh, okay.
We bought the hotel then, you see. So I was actually living in the hotel. I used to come up on a Monday and go back Thursday night. And I was taking for the last 6 months, I was taking the Fridays off, which was my annual leave. And, well, it worked out that I got nearly every Friday off. And that was that. But I've always kept my connection to the PDSA. And in theory, I am an ambassador for the PDSA, even to this very day. And I do get called in to do little things.
That was obviously a big part of your life. You really enjoyed it.
It was a very, very important part of my life. And the PDSA, fantastic organisation, just coming up to 100 years old in November this year. Founded by the marvellous, marvellous lady who is my hero, Mrs. Dickin. And her motto, before you say anything else, her motto was, if you want something doing, do it your blooming well self.
Or something to that effect.
Yeah, that's what she used to say.
And, of course, we're just at the milestone of the pirate radio stations having been closed down now for 50 years, aren't
yes, we? Yes, so yes.
Quite a couple of notable anniversaries at the moment.
Yeah.
Right, Paul, look, time has got ahead of us, as it always does with these things, and we're going to play your last track, which is We Are Family.
Yeah.
Why this one?
I like this one because it I can be quite flamboyant at times. And the film Le Cage aux Folles, which this is from The Birdcage in English, was a fantastic film and I absolutely love it. I love the storyline to the film as well, if you get a chance to see.
Well, this is Sister Sledge, which We Are Family from 1979. Paul Peters, it's been a delight again to have you, and I feel there's at least another one, maybe another two episodes of this to go. Will you come back and tell us the rest?
I'm sure I will.
Paul, for the time being, thank you very much indeed.
And thank you.